Hello, welcome to the Gregarious Mammal Podcast. We have been on holiday, 2 weeks holiday after 3 years, and we did nothing to do with tech apart from playing a few computer games and browsing maps. It was fun. A few episodes from interviews and things popped up in the feed, but not much else. But we're back with a Lynx show just to get up to speed, and then we'll have some more episodes for you coming soon. This is Chris, and over in front of me is...
This is Kate. Hello, everybody.
Hello. Okay, let's get straight into it. There's been a lot of big tech stories the past few weeks. We're going to skirt around the edges of some of them, acknowledging their presence like the elephant in the room they are, but we're not going to talk specifically about them. I think mostly because they've been talked about a lot already, but we're going to skirt around the edges of them and refer to some of them without explicitly kind of acknowledging their presence in a strange kind of way, like ignoring them at a party. Yes?
Yeah, at a party. That's kind of a nice way to look at it.
Okay. Let's get stuck right in. So we're going to revisit a story that we talked about in the past, but we now are looking at it from a different perspective. Kate, do you want to kick off with our first link?
Yeah, this is regarding Marcus Hutchins. You may know the story of Marcus Hutchins, a hardworking cybersecurity researcher who... a few months ago discovered a way to stop and circumvent the WannaCry cybersecurity attacks. So, you know, what happened was he was a bit of a hero. He was actually doing it anonymously for his good work, and then, of course, the media found out who he was and went to his home, and hence, you know, he got outed for his good deeds. He got some money in compensation, which he gave to charity, very noble there. But what's actually happened since then is he basically was at DEF CON in the US a couple of weeks ago, and was basically charged with a couple of crimes regarding earlier his earlier role, that he was allegedly part of the distribution of the banking malware Kronos in 2014. Now, whether he was... let's pull that apart a little bit. We're talking about the distribution of banking malware. There's no evidence so far that he actually distributed any of it, but that he knew about it, yes, and that he was researching it and had contact with the actual cyber criminals, if we can use that term, yes. And but the issue where it kind of gets interesting is one of the kind of the legislation they're using to charge him is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in the US. And bear in mind, he's a UK citizen in the US. He's been incarcerated. He got pulled up by the FBI while he was at DEF CON, like many good hackers doing good white hat, good for the world, you know, keeping our connected cars safe, to our, our sex toys or whatever, our connected televisions, whatever kind of area you want to go. And then he gets pulled up and thrown into jail. Into prison. I mean, I guess jail is the next step, isn't it? Or is it the other way around in America? Can't quite remember.
Aren't they the same thing? I don't know.
Jail and prison are a bit different. I always get them slightly confused because the American system is very different to the Australian system. So basically, he's out on bail as of a couple of days ago, but he has to stay in the US. As we said, he's not a citizen there. He's also not a resident. So it's not the nicest situation. But the bigger issue that comes into this is the whole issue of protecting researchers and white hackers, white hat hackers, shall we call them that? It's been pulled up by a number of people, like Brian Krebs from Krebs on Security, and I know the Electronic Frontiers Foundation have also done work on this, that this particular piece of legislation, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, has been used to bully and to charge researchers in the past. Some of this has been where they've been charged, the charges have been dropped. Some of it has been a period of ongoing harassment. One example, I'll just get it up here. Where's the guy's name? Justin Schaefer, you may have heard of this name, a well-known guy that was actually looking at insecurities in dental software. So where people, patients' data was being released into to the wilds. He's been raided on three distinct occasions and charged with under this legislation. despite the fact that what he was actually doing was, of course, research. He followed the right procedures. He reported these security vulnerabilities to the companies concerned. And then the companies used it as a means to get him charged, which sort of says something there. And more recently, it gets really weird. I mean, I actually have written an article on this for DZone, so as soon as it comes out, we'll put the link up. What's happened since, he was initially raided in 2016. Since then, he's been raided another two times, January and March this year.
This is the Schaefer.
Correct. Okay. And more recently, he's actually now, he was charged with cyberstalking for comments he allegedly made on Twitter about the FBI agents involved in...
Stalking FBI agents.
In harassing him in the first place.
He's a bit,
it's all very strange. And basically, the conditions of his release after those charges was that he not use social media. He wrote a blog about it, of course, and ended up back in custody.
Is that social media?
That's his argument. Is it social media? Is it free speech?
So this is okay. This is actually interesting. I mean, you've talked a little bit in detail about this particular story. I guess it's continuing.
It is,
but yeah. It's not an uncommon occurrence. And strangely, I lied slightly on holiday. I actually was talking with my dad about this subject, rather strangely. My dad, he sort of did maths and physics when he was younger, and he was actually involved in the very early computing industry. A lot of it has passed him by now. But just this attitude of there are companies who, if you challenge their superiority, they will say, "How dare you challenge our superiority? We're going to charge you." And it's other companies who say, "Well done. You just identified something we didn't do well. Show us how you did it, or come and join us, etc." And it's very specific with these sorts of cases where there are some companies when usually these people who are public are what so-called white hat hackers, the people who want to say, hey, excuse me, I've noticed a problem here. And a company says, "Wow, we didn't know about that. Thanks a lot." And there's companies who say, "How dare you? We will shoot you down." And in this case, And he actually, I mean, one thing you haven't mentioned, which I don't know if it was particularly clear even during the WannaCry outbreak, he actually works for a cybersecurity company.
That's right.
So that's actually their business, is to... This is the weird thing. Like, as his day job, it's his job to do this, but he did something... well, obviously, in this particular case, he's being charged for distributing malware. It's not the same thing as white hat hacking. But it's interesting. I mean, I think it's very grey area. If this is your sort of... your thing... is testing. It's very tempting, very easy to sort of potentially exploit some vulnerabilities you know about, because that's your job, you know about them. I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't be too hard to do it.
Yeah, look, it's a fair comment. I mean, we don't know how many, you know, black hat cyber hackers, if we can use those terms, are, you know, security experts who did it as a job and moved over to the dark side to make more money. But let's face it, these days you don't need to. I mean, you can buy a piece of a virus on the or a piece of ransomware on the darknet for less than $100. You can install it. It will tell you pretty much what to do. It's almost ransomware as a service, in that it's all set up for you, and it even suggests people you can send it to and hopefully get some money back. I mean, not that I'm endorsing that by any means.
Actually, on a sort of slightly related note, I would highly recommend you listen to on the Reply All podcast. They had a two-part episode kind of around one of these like Indian call centers who contacts you to say that you've been infected and etc. And the general intention is you buy some software, and that's often how some of these malware things work as well. Well, this isn't malware, this is social engineering, although as part of the process they then put malware on your machine that you then have to buy software to remove, you know. And it's actually a really fascinating insight into this. The hosts actually go to India to try and track down the people. It's unfortunately, it ends up being somewhat inconclusive, much to the frustration of the hosts as well. But it was really fascinating just to get an insight into the people behind this. And they don't they're so surprised when these two Americans turn up trying to, like, don't understand why they're there. It was quite interesting.
Yeah, and look, it's worth also sort of saying that this is an area where, of course, there are grey areas, but it's also about wanting citizens to have due process, to be treated fairly by the judicial system, to be not unduly harassed without ever getting charged with things. And these are the things that seem to be happening. And a particular case that it comes back to is that of Aaron Schwartz, that you might remember in 2013 committed suicide because he was arrested at MIT this is my understanding, he connected a computer to the MIT network in a closet, the aim being to download academic journal articles with the, you know, as part of a movement that they should be free and accessible to everyone. And they used this Computer Fraud Abuse Act, amongst a couple of other ones as well, to, you know, charge him. And after that, he actually committed suicide. He was... So, you know, it shows that even just having these things as a risk or a risk of your personal safety and security as an individual really do have consequences on people's lives.
One final thing on this. It was actually another... I know now he's somewhat sullied his reputation, but there's an interesting book written by Julian Assange and a professor from, I think, Sydney University, because Julian Assange is actually Australian, despite the fact the Australian government never even acknowledges that fact.
Yeah, funny that.
about the early days of the hacking culture in Melbourne in the 90s. Yeah. It's actually a fascinating book. I can't remember what it's called, but if you look up Julian Assange books...
We can find a link.
You'll find it. It's a free. Yeah. It's freely available.
Yeah, it's open source.
Legally.
Yeah.
And one aspect of that, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things in this book, but one particular aspect of that is in this particular era and up until recently, so Melbourne had a very big hacking culture, and I think still does, I'm not sure, but there was this attitude that if you were going to get caught, you should hand yourself over to the Australian police before the Americans got involved, because the Australian police would just give you a slap on the wrist and let you out in 6 months. Whereas with the American police, they would probably throw away the key. So this was always the interesting aspect that, and I would say the UK is probably becoming as bad. I'm not sure about Australia now, but this whole thing of if you're going to get caught, you're probably better off getting caught in your own country as opposed to the US, because they'll probably be nicer to you. Anyway, it was an interesting thing to look into too.
Yeah,
and he is British, not American.
Yeah, so. That's true. And just in conclusion, I'd encourage people, if you are interested in these issues and pulling it apart a bit more and exploring it, I'll put the article on the our website for the podcast. I'll also put some links. I'd really encourage people to check out the Electronic Frontiers Foundation and the really good work they do in this area. They even bring their own lawyers to DEF CON for anyone that's being harassed or being told by companies they can't give their demo of how to hack products.
And we'll supply all links to get in touch with us if you have something to say.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's move on to the next subject. This is one that's kind of dearer to me, but crosses over into other boundaries. Stack Overflow, the infamous Stack Overflow, the infamous, as now there are mock books released by O'Reilly on learn to copy and paste from Stack Overflow, implying that's how most people learn to code these days, which is possibly quite true. And Stack Overflow is often when you're looking for the solution to a coding problem is where you end up, for good or evil. And there's been many articles, and actually I even saw an interview in the very building we're currently in now with one of the founders of Stack Overflow. And despite its wide usage, it's still financially, you know, it doesn't make as much money as you may think just because it's popular. It's like Wikipedia. Just because it's popular doesn't mean they make a lot of money, because that's not always being their business model. But anyway, they started not that long ago attempting a documentation section of the sort of Stack Overflow family, because they obviously have a lot of different sort of related products in quote marks. And already they've decided to sunset it.
Sunset it, what does that mean?
Close it down, basically.
Right.
Because the two reasons. One is that they decided they don't really have the resources, see previous comment, to maintain it properly. But the other one, and this is what sort of sparked the most conversation in the communities that I move in, is that documentation is hard. Mm. And if they'd spoken to any of us, we could have told them that, because that's what we do for a day job. Their intention being to sort of centralize project documentation for people looking for answers to things in one place. And yeah, documentation is hard. Encouraging engineers to do it is hard. Doing it well is hard. Centralizing it in one place is hard. Managing it is hard. And there's been, I would encourage you to look. Actually, I'll add them in the show notes because I don't think there's a really particularly easy way of finding it. But there's been a lot of sort of related blog posts from the community coming out around this and ideas around how it could have been done better, what people have learned from it. And also the I think it's Joel, I think, is the guy who posted the post and who's the guy I saw who... No, John. No, it's a different person. Anyway, about what they learned from it and... Yeah, I guess anyone who is interested in documentation, I was never entirely clear on what they were attempting to accomplish with this and what a metric of success would have even been. So it's interesting to see that they gave up so quickly, but what people have learned from it. And then, yeah, the community's responses to those learnings has been quite interesting, actually. So,
just a general question from me. I mean, did they have like a dedicated... pool of staff or a team doing
That's unclear, yeah. But they did certainly say that they felt that maybe the staff who were involved in it in whatever capacity relating to the success and the complexity and the difficulty of the project, that they're probably better on other things.
Like, was there a community behind them? Like, you...
So Stack Overflow, yeah, Stack Overflow is all community, really.
It is. Okay. So is it open source community kind of?
No, it's not open source. Okay. You probably have used Stack Overflow.
I'm sure I've used it, not realized it.
it's one of these places you end up for coding questions, sure. And it works very well. People argue about how well it works.
I think that's why I thought it was
in this sort of question and answer space, but in terms of being a repository of knowledge in a more traditional sense, maybe that wasn't a good idea for them. And it sort of made sense conceptually, but whether it made sense for them is the kind of bigger question. But I encourage you to read their blog post, and then I'll put a few links to blog posts that came out of it from our community, the technical writers community. That's quite interesting. And one of the more popular responses has been from quite a well-known guy in the community called Tom Johnson, who I do the Write the Docs podcast with, amongst other people. And I was actually talking to him on an aborted attempt to record our podcast because people got delayed in traffic about my idea for having using bots and chatbots to interact with documentation, because it enables people to interact with it in a much more question answer way, as opposed to knowing what they're looking for. And he put this into his blog post briefly, and I hope to have a prototype of this very soon for the Write the Docs conference in September, at least just a conceptual prototype about how that could work.
I think we'll have to interview you on that.
Well, it's very conceptual at the moment. Sounds... but anyway, I encourage you to read around that and yeah, have a look some more.
For sure. Sounds super interesting.
Okay. There's an interesting kind of work-related articles there, and now we're going to move on to a couple of others that are more sort of skirting around the edges of technological culture. And here is this fascinating article and somewhat damning article on The Atlantic. That's quite a long read, but I think it's worthwhile to read.
Definitely.
Called Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? And I mean, I find this interesting. So there's definitely some negative numbers here. Things like that, you know, well, it's interesting as well. Actually, this came up in a discussion amongst some friends. What is a millennial? What is a Gen Xer, etc.?
Yeah.
And I always thought I was a Gen Xer, but apparently being born in 1981, I'm counted as a millennial, which is news to me. But anyway, but now there's now post-millennial, so God knows what that means. But whatever, let's talk about, let's say, people who are approaching adulthood or just entered adulthood. Maybe that's the best term to use, that kind of age bracket, like 16 to early 20s.
I believe, to just clarify, it's people born between 1995 and 2012.
I guess that's it.
So it's kind of the cohort, the author of this article.
That's actually 6 year olds.
Talking about. Correct.
Yeah.
And so just to give you some context, if you haven't read the article...
Well, let me just finish what I was saying, because I was about to just wrap up that sentence.
Sorry.
Was that... there's some very negative numbers here about depression and suicide rates and things like that, which we'll dig into. But then there's some interesting potentially positive aspects. People saying, oh, teenagers don't go out drinking anymore, do drugs less, have sex less. And it's kind of like, well, that's what teenagers were always supposed to do, but because they're doing it less, is that necessarily a bad thing? But I think it's the aspect that they're doing them less because they're interacting with people less is possibly the negative connotation. But this is, of course, always previous generations will always judge the next generation by their standards. So that's a thing to bear in mind. Let's dig into this. What do you think, Kate?
Yeah, look, it's a super interesting article. Just to give you a quick, really quick overview, it's basically a researcher who's been researching differences in culture and different life experiences in people through different age groups, and has discovered that the post-millennial, is that the right term?
Apparently.
Sorry, we may be a bit clumsy with some of this terminology. The post-millennial people, so people born 1995 above, have had some significant shifts, and a lot of them really hark back to the kind of the idea that I was a little bit critical of some of the article. It basically bases it, the statistics the woman's collected basically say that people in this age group have sex less, drink less, go out less, unless it's with their parents, work less, so they're not doing after-school jobs.
It's not necessarily their choice.
Drive less, like, so they don't learn to drive as statistically often. But, I mean, I would actually, and she sort of attributes a lot of this to, you know, this miasma of depression and feelings of social isolation and feeling excluded, to this whole thing about, oh, it's because they're spending all this time on their phones, on social media or Snapchat or whatever you want to call it. And I'd actually like to pull it apart a bit. I'm a little bit critical of some of this because, firstly, I'd contend that, firstly, if we look, let's look at some of those ideas. People are having sex less. They're probably a generation that was brought up with the abstinence model in schools. When you think of parts of America...
This is an American article, don't
correct.
Think it. It's, some of the things, you know, that were labelled as a traditional teenager would not
it's,
be
it's illegal to teach about birth control. Yeah. So you've got this juxtaposition between, you know, abstinence being taught at schools, if they're taught anything, let's be honest, and then you've got the porn kind of industry, which is in our face every day. So, you know, it would be fair to imagine that your social engagements with people of the opposite sex or the same sex or however you want to define yourself would be a little different. Secondly, you've got the idea, oh, they're not working as much. Well, I'd probably put that down to access to jobs.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, let's break it down. You've got a large swank of people in America who are working minimum wage jobs. Probably some of those are insecure jobs like casual and sessional, whatever kinds of contracts or dubious contracts people are on. So they're not actually having those jobs available for young people after school if they're being taken over by older people. Sorry, that's my computer whirring since I plugged it in. I don't...
Not entirely sure what's
going on. It's this whirring.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, just we're charging our computers in this little multi-faceted PowerPoint device that started whirring really loudly, so apologies if you can hear that. I actually closed my computer to try and fix it, but it didn't fix it. So not sure there. But yeah, and then you break it down. Okay, they're going out less. That's probably because they have less money. It's also, I would say, the erosion of public space that young people can congregate in. It's very hard to be young these days and have somewhere to go.
Without being labelled as obnoxious teenagers who should be off the streets. This is the ironic thing. It's like, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Like in Australia, you even have areas where if youths of more than three people congregate, they can be considered a public nuisance.
Yeah.
God knows what it's like in some parts of America. They're a bit more conservative.
So you just talked about some of the yardsticks, some of the measures of what this writer thinks is they should be doing instead. But let's actually talk a little bit about maybe some of the positives or some of the things that have changed the other way. So traditionally, you and I are both old enough to remember, and you grew up in a smaller town, I grew up in the suburbs of a larger town, they could be equated to be similar-ish, but we probably both had experiences at school and at high school and even lower years of university when, you know, you were forced to kind of hang out with people who you sort of got on with because there was no other choice, you shared some interests, etc., etc. And then as the internet slowly emerged, you could find these people who were just like you. It opened up this world of realizing you weren't alone. Before going to university, where you tended to meet more people like you, and you were also mature enough that you just didn't have such bullshit kind of bullying, you could find all these people who you could connect with. And I would say that that was a positive of the internet, but possibly it's gone almost too far. But I think the difference now is you have that plus this constant measurement, this constant numbers, this constant monitoring of, am I better than them? I did this video and it got 2 clicks, 5 clicks, 10 likes, whatever. I did this other one and it didn't. And this constant kind of measuring yourself. And
so comparisons, do you mean?
Measuring yourself. Mm. But comparisons, yeah. And even you feel it yourself as an adult as well. So God knows what it's like for children when this is so important. You just have to watch any kind of American teen film to have this constant kind of structuring of your teen society, and it's even worse now. And this is what leads to depression, and this, you know, you're very connected through a screen to a global maybe community, but your immediate sort of world is very small.
And very true.
I mean, even as adults, we find ourselves susceptible to it. So as a child, when this stuff is so much more important, it's hard to think back to how you used to feel in that time. But you know that everything seemed incredibly important when it really wasn't, but that's how you felt. And I think it exacerbates it and it focuses it, and this constant measuring doesn't help. You know, we would connect with communities who we agreed with when we were younger on the internet, but you didn't have this constant measurement around it. Like, we kept live journals, but we didn't really care how many people read them at the time so much.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sadder parts of it was actually the comment that people who had kind of, you know, were already communicating on social media, when they'd meet in person, it was even worse because they'd take photographs and, you know, share that they'd met in person or were, you know, hanging out or whatever. And then that meant that other people felt even more excluded. So it's kind of like you can't win, you know, they're your friends online, but maybe not in person, but then in person that, you know, becomes this kind of juxtaposition. So it's quite sad. I mean, you know, and it's very easy for people like social kind of policy kind of people or people into, you know, youth counselling or welfare or whatever to throw their hands up and say, oh, well, just get off the internet, go and play, go and do something. But I think those things, go and do something that's not involved in tech, I think those things can be a little bit flippant in understanding the reality of people's emotional well-being.
Yeah, look, I highly recommend you go and read this article, whatever your age, whatever your background.
Definitely.
It's very American, but yeah, lines that jump out at me are things like even driving, which, I mean, Kate and I, neither of us driving. It's a very American thing. Even driving, a symbol of adolescent freedom inscribed in American popular culture, from Rebel Without a Cause to Ferris Bueller's Day Off, has lost its appeal. And I think American cities are very different, especially from European cities. Like, we live in a medium-sized European city and you don't need to drive.
I think people were taught driving at school in America at one point. Sure. I don't know if that's still the case, because that's something you don't get in Australia. You have to pay yourself.
But anyway, it's a fascinating article. Yeah. I really recommend you read it. We'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Very interesting. Especially any Americans who are actually out there, because it's whilst some of it is very broad and very global, some of it is very American too. And some of it, I'd say, so what? Teenagers are drinking less. That's not a bad thing. But are they better in other ways? I'm not sure. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Let's move on. Let's go to the complete other end of the spectrum. And we're actually going to talk about older people now.
Yeah.
And this skirts around the edges of one of the elephants in the room of the tech news from the past fortnight, that of diversity and a particular search company and a particular
whoever
person.
Whoever do you mean?
But we, yes, Ask Jeeves had a real problem. No, we won't really go into any tremendous detail about that.
No.
But we're going to talk about, I mean, I'm a white male. I can't really talk about some aspects of diversity, but there are other, to me, diversity is all sorts of things. And one in particular that we're going to talk about here is age, which, you know, diversity covers many facets, and some are better or worse represented than others, but we're going to talk about age.
And I might add, it's something we've covered in the past because it's something we feel quite strongly about as people that, you know, I entered a career in, if you can call it that, in tech in my 40s, and like people, the average person in a tech company these days is in their 20s. Despite that, the average age of an American, I think Australians pretty similar, is 42, so my age. So, you know, it is, I believe it is
going. Kate, You've just publicly admitted your age. Despite
well, that's one thing you do get told. I have been told this by a number of people. Don't tell people your age in tech. Mm. You'll be treated poorly or disparaged or ignored because your age makes you obsolete.
Maybe. So let's quickly skip through this article because we're already running a little later, longer than we expected.
We have too many opinions,
so this
clearly.
This is an article on Wired.
Yes.
The person actually is at Google, strangely, or has been at Google. I can't quite remember.
Yeah, it's a good piece.
They're talking about their experience. So let's just jump in. And this person is actually in their 60s. Let's jump into a few things. So they talk about socialising and how a lot of socialising activities at a lot of tech companies can be very physical or often late night or involve kind of high consumption.
You have an example of this, don't you, from a company you're working with?
Yeah, but this was an Austrian company whose main office head office was actually in the mountains. It was very much part of their culture. It wasn't necessarily... It was just part of their lifestyle. Mm. And actually, as the company grew and their main office became more and more here in Berlin, they changed where they went for work trips. But yeah, I had some horrific times when they were like, we went bouldering and like, Chris, just jump off. It's like, I grew up in fucking London. I'm not jumping off cliffs. That's not something I do. But to them, it was very natural.
It's like my worst nightmare.
To me, a city liver, it's like, I don't want to do that. That's not fun. And just feeling really, really awkward because... Anyway, yeah. So things like that. Career development, of course. Just because you're over a certain age doesn't mean you don't want to continue. Actually, on a side note, I read an article recently about... a problem with American politics of there being so many senators over the age of 70.
Yeah.
So just saying there are certain industries where you can be old and you keep going.
Very much.
Apparently all the three front runners for the next kind of presidential candidate for the Democrats are all over 70.
Wow.
Including Sanders. They're all over 70.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You can get involved a lot in mentoring, of course.
Yeah, it's a very good...
One thing that is often overlooked in terms of experience with older people is just that experience of, A, diversity. You've got a more diverse set of opinions because you've been around longer, whether that be from how things used to be done and et cetera, or just multiple life experiences that have taught you lessons.
Mm.
But also just... I've done some work with a company writing some articles for their blog, and they have a lot of engineers involved who've been around for a long time. And hearing their stories of startups they worked with in the 90s and stuff like that, and how things used to be, is often a very valuable lesson for younger people. Younger people have this, generally we do the same thing ourselves, of, oh, who cares? I don't want to hear about how it used to be.
Mm.
But sometimes realising how things used to be can teach you a lot about how things are now.
I think the big thing that those workers can bring, or any of us can bring, or should bring to a role, is our resiliency. We can demonstrate to people that maybe at the beginning of their career that, you know, it is possible to have things go wrong, spectacularly wrong at times, and you do come out the other end. And this is not something that gets shared that much unless it's a celebrated failure that someone talks about publicly in a, you know, a TEDx talk or something.
Yeah. So here's some other interesting aspects that the writer mentions as well.
Mm.
Things like phased retirement. I would especially say, I'm going to generalise broadly here, but I'd especially say men have a tendency, once they've retired, to get really down and feeling like they have no purpose. And especially now, as like 65 is this kind of number we've plucked out of thin air. And as we age, we sort of age later now, and we die later, mostly, retiring at 65. Like, you've still got probably 10 years left in you.
Oh, at least.
And you're bored. Like, you're bored. So this phased retirement I find really interesting.
Yeah.
And you could also then pair in with the mentoring of an intern, for example. You're working less, they're only entering the workforce, and you can kind of job share together, maybe. They also talk about benefits and perks. So whilst younger people will want, I mean, this is not particularly widespread, but egg freezing and IVF programs.
What?
They're saying for the opposite end of the spectrum, things like, they label it very American way, elder care. Caring for partners who have developed various conditions that you might need to
degenerative conditions.
Exactly. It's very interesting.
And the other thing I'd say, and this is also one of those elephants in the room that people shuffle about uncomfortably, is that in almost every country, and there may be some exceptions, people are having to work longer for financial reasons.
Doesn't mean they can. There's an option for them.
You know, that they are in a situation where being able to access a pension plan or a benefit of some sort upon retirement or retrenchment. In some countries, they're not there, or the amounts are so pitiful, unless you own a home, which, again, that's something that's changing as well. It can be very hard to support yourself.
And even your parents, who went through the very traditional kind of route, they had their super plans slashed by the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah.
So even people who were intending to follow the traditional path may not have been able to do it for as long as they hoped.
Yeah, I remember reading something recently about baby boomers, so people that are perhaps in their 60s and 70s now, still paying off their college loans.
Really?
Yeah.
In America. Yeah, and my dad has seen his property value slashed for various reasons, some of them his fault. But not all baby boomers are as lucky as we sometimes think. Anyway, let's wrap up the four very interesting links we discussed there, and please, and we'll add some links in the show notes to our public Slack channel or to Twitter or to comment threads where you can add your thoughts and opinions. But let's wrap up with what we've been up to and what we are up to over the next few weeks. Kate, if you want to kick off with some things that you've had published over the past few weeks and what you're working on that's going to get published very soon.
I've been mostly writing a lot about security in the last a couple of weeks, working on some articles there. I've also got some articles coming up to do with our smart cities and looking a bit critically at the idea of the smart city and who it benefits and who gets left on the wayside, particularly to do with socioeconomic status. That'll be a very interesting article. I'm also super looking forward to this week. I think it's tomorrow in my calendar. I've got an interview with someone who was a chef making pizzas in a food van, and then decided he wanted to make a robot dedicated to Nicolas Cage. And as a response, he...
I don't even know where to start.
He got in with the Node.js community, which, one of the many weird and wonderful tech communities out there for people interested in coding. Learned to code from scratch as an absolute beginner without, a degree or what have you. But did make his creation. I'll be looking forward to seeing that, getting a little demo. And now runs the local chapter of Node.js in his area. So I'm really looking forward to talking to him, because I think I always really enjoy talking to people who do, like myself, do meet tech in a less conventional way than perhaps going from schooling to a job.
And we've actually did a bunch of interviews and articles before we kind of went on holiday.
Yeah.
Our website is a little bit behind because we're having a slight build error right now that I need to fix. But I can tell you that in the next... We have a bunch of articles. I've written some things on Heroku for a company called CoralLogix, which was very interesting because they actually got them a lot of customers, which is good.
Fantastic.
I interviewed one of the product managers from Nginx, which is interesting. I actually wrote an article on Podcasting 101 for Mac users, for Cult of Mac. And then before we went on holiday, Kate and I interviewed the founder of Meetup.com, which was interesting.
Very interesting.
We also interviewed Livu Babbitt. These have all popped up on the podcast feed. Mm. If you didn't know, you can go back and find them.
Yeah.
Who claims to be one of the first cyborgs.
Oh, yes.
And I interviewed Yael Eisenstadt, who was an ex-CIA operative who is very much now into the impact of tech on our society. And Kate, I can also see you've had a few articles on drones in retail, picking an IoT platform, and possibly some other things.
Yeah.
And coming up in the near future, if you want to meet us, I will be at Write the Docs in Prague. We will both be at Startup Night here in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will both be in various capacities at Voxt Belgrade, going back to Belgrade, a city I love. So you can meet us there too.
And if you're, doing some planning for later in the year, we will be at Web Summit in Lisbon in November.
Yes.
So
I will also be at IT Arena in the Ukraine. I can't remember the exact name of the city or the date, but look that up.
Yeah, I know I've got a few other IoT conferences here in Berlin, for enterprise ones. So if you're in the industrial space or you wear a suit or whatever, and you I say that because it's that kind of audience. Yeah. You know, I stick out a little bit.
So we're going to have to wrap up the show because we're actually about to jump into our office hours here at the factory in Berlin. We'll be going to help tech startups who want to explain themselves better and bear that in mind if you're in Berlin. But we're also happy to do those remotely with people if you're interested.
Of course.
Firstly, Kate, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, look, you can. We have our contact details on our website.
You actually have a new shiny webpage.
We do.
Tell people
we
where
have,
they can find your contact details.
KateLawrence.com.
Exactly.
So C-H.
Kate with a C.
Yeah. To the W. If you Google it, I'm sure you'll find.
Probably not yet, but.
But yeah, not yet because I haven't done much yet.
And likewise, you can find all my contact details on ChristianChiller.com. Yeah. And if you're specifically interested in the podcast, you can go to gregariousmammal.com/podcast, find previous episodes, same URL /support if you want to donate some money, buy some merchandise. And actually, we're going to have new chinchilla and cat stickers, Kate's new logo, available very soon.
And
so if you want a sticker, let us know and we'll send you. We're going to have 5mm and 7.5mm stickers you can use with our various icons.
And for something a bit different, next time we shoot the podcast at home as opposed to in our co-working space, we will be having a visitor there who will be sleeping through the podcast. We'll do a little feed of her her participation. So if you're sitting at work and you want to just watch something on the screen, you get to see a cat sleeping.
And probably actually our next episode we'll have a live interview, and if you have any questions specifically for that person, please send them in. We will be talking with Ben Maddox of the Perfect Information podcast, who is very entertaining.
Ah.
A British guy who's also an actor, so he's very entertaining.
Oh, yes.
About tech in board games. So a subject that's of interest to me, and he will be very entertaining.
Lastly, I'd say too, if you have a product or just an opinion that you want to share with us on the podcast, please feel free to get in touch. We're pretty accessible and we're always keen to have a chat.
Links in the show notes. Let's wrap this baby up and send it down the shops for a packet of cigarettes because kids need to smoke more, god damn it.
Oh, mom.